Good morning. It is 10:03 on January 31st, 2018. I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of the Public Service Commission. I call this meeting to order. With me are Commissioners Brian Krasius and Julie Fedorchak. So we have a quorum, and the agenda has been sent out. As far as opening comments, I will say that I just arrived back yesterday afternoon from the quarterly meeting of SPP, one of the two regional transmission organizations that North Dakota companies are a part of. A lot of things to discuss in SPP's case. Part of the SPP is the RSC, which is the regional state council that each state involved has a commissioner on, and actually does the allocation decisions. However, most of the conversation was, again, which it has been pretty much the whole time I've been doing these, was about the Mountain West acquisition, which is really significant increase in this organization if it happens. It includes much or all of Colorado and Wyoming and quite a bit of Montana and then some snips of a couple other states. Pretty significant expansion, and I would say there's a lot of concern about it from some of the RSC commissioners that trying to determine whether there is good and clear evidence that this expansion will in fact bring new efficiencies as opposed to just a theory that you just grow for the purpose of growing and growing always brings more efficiencies and wanting more clarity in that regard. And so it's a continuing discussion, and I'm not sure which way it's ultimately going to go or, in fact, what the best decision is, because the clarity that I mentioned earlier as to exactly what the efficiencies are that will be gained by the expansion just haven't been brought forth yet in a good way to the RSC board. So we'll continue with that, and that concludes my opening comments. Commissioner Krasius.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today, our consumer contact report is released, and I guess the punchline on that is, for the most part, complaints, contacts, inquiries into the commission were just a little bit below 2016. And one noticeable point in particular related to Dakota Access Pipeline. In 2016, we had 105 of the public input contacts were related to DAPL, and that dropped in 2017 to 32, and most of those occurred at the beginning of 2017, so that has essentially tapered off to nothing. And overall, the three companies, the regulated utilities that we track and monitor, MDU, XL, or NSP, and Ottertail, were roughly about the same in terms of number of informal complaints that we received from those three. So overall, a slight decrease in those numbers and on par with 2016. So Stacy does an incredible amount of work, and she is actually the individual that takes these calls. And they're not always the easiest calls to take. When you have someone calling in, obviously, to place a complaint, an informal complaint, it is not always the easiest thing to have to deal with. So thank you, Stacy, for your work on that and for being the front line. But these the calls that do come into the commission are incredibly important. It's about having, as a state agency should, an open-door policy and interacting with the public. And it's valuable information. That the information we receive helps guide us in terms of areas of need, areas of concern, or areas we should be concerned with. So public feedback is the barometer not only with how companies are performing, or not only for how companies are performing, but also gives us a sense of direction as a commission as well. And then just one other point, and this will be on the admin part of the meeting. MDU, the gas rate case, we're going to talk a little bit about that. And one thing that the company is requesting that we'll be discussing is an extension in terms of when the hearing takes place. And that extension request is being driven by just the need to further calculate the effects, the impact of the tax reform bill. And we've talked about it as a commission in terms of, for all of the companies, what impact will it have on customer rates. But additional questions I have, and this isn't something we regulate, the rate part is, but whenever you have tax reform, that would be one component in this case, but another component would be capital expenditures that the company may not make otherwise, but diverting those savings into more capital expenditures, which could drive growth. Does it mean wage increases for the employees at those utilities? And does it lead to job creation? So that would be not the regulatory side of me, but the citizen side of me. That's always curious and wanting to know more about those things. So that, and then just the other part that thing I wanted to mention, just an incredible amount of movement right now in the natural gas space. One Oak announced the Cherry Creek pipeline that starts in Montana, travels down to Kansas, I believe. Bear Den Processing Plant is seeking to expand, and then Elk Creek is another pipeline that is within, or I believe I mixed those up. Cherry Creek actually is a pipeline in North Dakota. The Elk Creek pipeline is the one that starts in Montana, but we're just seeing more and more movement in the natural gas space to not only reduce flaring levels, but also to capture that gas, process it, and create some additional value-added propositions for the state. So I expect we'll continue to be very busy in that space as well.
Thank you, Commissioner Fedorchak.
Well, good morning, everyone. I wanted to just add to a couple of comments that Commissioner Krosh has made about the customer service side of things and the report that was put out today announcing how many contacts we had in the past year. I'm not running for election this year. My colleagues are. So I'm in a good position to step back and say this, but it's often a popular approach for challengers to this office to say, I'm going to run for this office because I'm going to put the service back in the Public Service Commission. And I think that this report and others that we've done in past years really show that service is firmly planted in our mission, and it's firmly planted in the work that we do every single day at the Commission. We are constantly receiving calls and working to answer complaints in an efficient and accessible way to the public, and Stacy does a fabulous job of answering things that even aren't related to what our agency does, but directing people as best she can to a source of help and not just putting them off and saying that's not our job. So I think that I just want to emphasize that this whole consumer affairs portfolio is really focused on the service part of what we do. And also yesterday I was speaking to the strengthening relationships and partnerships event that Governor Burgum and the State Indian Affairs Commission held in collaboration with all the state's tribal entities. And in my comments to that group, I also emphasized that this isn't just something that we give lip service to, that we want to be transparent and that we want to have an open conversation with the public. That's our goal. That's what we do. That's at the core of why we exist, is to be that entity that can hear from and weigh all the different competing interests that are out there as it relates to all these different projects, and to listen and to actually put those comments to work and try to use them to improve the final product of whatever is being proposed and considered and permitted. And so that is, again, at the core of what we're doing, and we're very serious about it. And I think that we deliver on that promise every day at the Commission, along with all of our staff. So thank you to Stacy and others and staff that are constantly working to be responsive to the public. The second thing I just wanted to briefly talk about was the President's State of the Union speech. He talked a lot about energy development in his speech and regulatory reform, and we certainly are seeing that at the Commission in a lot of the different areas, the coal side of things, the pipeline side of things, the regulatory side of things, where he really has streamlined processes and eliminated red tape. And it has not just given lip service to this concept of energy development, but we're actually really seeing that play out in North Dakota. So I was cheering some of the comments in that regard. And then in his tax reform, Brian mentioned, again, the impact that that tax reform is going to have on the utilities. When Randy and I were meeting with our fellow commissioners from the Midwest a couple weeks ago, we talked more about that. And I've called it a 14% decrease in the corporate tax rate, but really it's a 40% cut. Effectively, it's a 40%. It drops 14 percentage points, but it's a 40% reduction for the utilities, for corporations. And so that's going to have a significant impact. Customers will be seeing that on their bills. And those customers, that's everybody. It isn't just the business customers. It isn't just the wealthy customers. It's everybody. I also wanted to share a story that's not directly related to the PSC, but a friend of mine owns a small business in town here, and he has maybe a handful of employees. One of employees got their first check after the new year and went and saw him after he got that check and said, "I didn't realize I was getting a raise. My check is different. Did you give me a raise?" They looked at it. It was his tax cut. He actually thought he got a raise. So this tax reform is a real deal, despite what a lot of folks are saying. It is affecting all Americans. And I think we need to be straightforward and honest about the truth of what that is and how it's impacting our economy. So just my 2 cents worth on that subject this morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You reminded me of something, and I'd kind of alluded to it in an earlier discussion with Stacy on the Consumer Affairs Report. And whether it's Stacy or occasionally someone else here at the agency that ends up taking these consumer calls, because we have a rather generic-sounding name, we get calls that don't fall under our jurisdiction. And from day one for me at the Commission, I've been impressed that despite the fact that our resources and time are limited too, our staff just has the decency and the goodness to try to the extent possible, help these people who sometimes call us because they're just exasperated. They have this issue. They can't figure out where to go to get it resolved. And maybe Public Service Commission would cover this. And to the extent possible, our folks try to help them. And I've always just really appreciated that about our team here. So, okay, on the consent agenda, we have 5 items plus approval of minutes of previous meetings. I move approval.
Second. We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Commissioner Crosses, do you mind going ahead of me? I think I left one folder on my desk with...
Yep, not at all. I will.
My agenda item.
Okay. Okay, I have one item on the agenda. I move the Commission issue a notice of hearing in Northern States Power Company Advanced Prudence 302.4 megawatt Dakota Range Wind application case number PU-17-372.
Second.
A public hearing on the application in case number 17-372 is scheduled to begin March 21st, 2018 at 9 a.m. Central Daylight Time in the Commission Hearing Room on the 12th floor of the State Capitol, 600 East Boulevard Avenue, here in Bismarck. On October 10th, 2017, Northern States Power Company, NSP, filed an application for an advanced determination of prudence to build, own, and operate the proposed 302.4-megawatt Dakota Range 1 and 2 wind projects to be located near Watertown, South Dakota. The issues to be considered in this matter are whether NSP's proposed resource additions are prudent. For more information, individuals can contact the Public Service Commission here at the State Capitol at 701-328-2400. And just a few points on this. Again, this is to be will be located in South Dakota, and NSP right now seeks to qualify for 80% of the production tax credit, meaning this facility would have to be placed in service by the end of 2021. They stated that in their application as one of the drivers for wanting to build this. And some issues we'll be considering and looking at. Does this provide reliable and affordable energy to consumers? That will be a big part of this, as well as the cost comparison versus other similar projects in terms of construction costs. We'll be taking a look at that. And one of the things that NSP and other companies looking at projects like this, right now, because of the expiration of the production tax credit, they're looking to lock in and what they view as long-term value for their customers. And again, that's tied back to the production tax credit. One thing that is occurring, though, and I get this when I'm out and traveling and speaking to people, with the renewable resources coming online, why aren't my energy costs going down? And it's a common question, and it's a fair question, frankly, and it's something that is worth asking. And one of the reasons, the resources that are currently in place that provide the capacity that we need to energize and to provide electricity to both households and businesses, right now we have enough capacity. So this is more about companies looking forward at future capacity needs. But at the same time, you have having those existing resources, baseload facilities, which continue to perform very well and are very, you know, extremely valuable in the whole scheme of things. But the consumer still has to pay for the new project, and they're also paying for the projects that are on the ground and in operation currently. So if there's an early retirement, that can also fall on the backs of the consumers in terms of who pays for that early retirement of a facility. So at the end of the day, we really have to take a hard look, and not necessarily from a commission standpoint, but we have to take a hard look at what is the energy resource strategy in the future and going forward, because we want to make sure that these resources are in fact prudent and that they're needed and they ultimately provide value in terms of rate relief to our customer base. So that is something from a commission standpoint that I will be taking a very hard look at.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay, was that? That was the only item on your...
You have no more time, there. Randy. I have nothing else.
Well, it was here. It was here all along.
So. Oh. I even talked a little more just to kind of stretch it out for you.
Thank you.
Talk slowly.
We had such large volume in our consent calendar that my agenda item got lost in it. So, okay, RC1, I move the commission approve bond release number 8 for surface coal mining permit number BNCR-8106 held by BNI Coal Limited for the Center Mine to release all reclamation liabilities on 56.47 acres located in the southeast quarter of Section 35, Township 142 North, Range 84 West in Oliver County. No monetary release is being requested since the current bond amount is based on the worst-case reclamation condition at the center mine. The bond release will become effective March 2, 2018, unless a formal hearing is requested.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
The bond release tract here contains 53.05 acres, as I said, of reclaimed cropland and hayland, and about 3.5 acres of county road and section line right-of-way. About 1.5 acres of land on the south boundary of the bond release tract that includes the section line trail and a portion of the field was never disturbed by mining. The mining activities on about 21 acres initially occurred prior to July 1, 1975. Another 15.5 acres were mined after the 75 law changes became effective, and then about 20 acres were disturbed after the 1977 reclamation law went into effect. BNI decided to use the stricter regulation, the stricter revegetation success standards applicable to the 1977 law to prove reclamation success on the entire bond release tract, even the stuff that was mined before that law went into effect. Topsoil and subsoil respread thickness were checked with a tile spade during the bond release inspection to verify the topsoil respread thickness. BNI was required to demonstrate that the productivity of the reclaimed hayland was restored to the pre-mine level on the bond release tract. I will point out that by landowner and the farmer operator request, this has since been shifted from hayland to cropland. It was in canola last year, but the productivity levels were based on the original hayland production. That hayland production on the reclaimed lands met or exceeded the adjusted standard for all the years data was collected. The application included documentation that Oliver County has accepted the reconstructed road back into the county road system. However, during reconstruction of the county road, an overpass was installed to allow traffic to cross over BNI's primary haul road, and this overpass must be removed when the primary haul road is ultimately reclaimed. So approximately 1.7 acres that includes the right-of-way along the northeast side of the bond release tract was deleted from the release application to allow equipment access for the removal and reclamation of that overpass sometime in the future, but that's a long ways out. The formal final bond release inspection was conducted June 24th of 2015. Six representatives from the Reclamation Division and BNI reps participated in the inspection. The landowner, the farmer operator, representatives from Oliver County Soil Conservation District, the Oliver County Highway Department, and the Oliver County Commission were all invited but did not attend the inspection. The newspaper notice for the final bond release was published in the Center Republican, the official county newspaper, once a week for four consecutive weeks from June 4th of 2015 to June 25th of 2015. No objections or written comments were received on the bond release application. BNI is not requesting any monetary reduction in the bond amount, since the current bond amount for the consolidated bond area is needed to cover the worst-case reclamation condition. If approved, the release, as I said in the motion, becomes effective March 2nd of 2018, unless a formal hearing is requested by an interested party. And also, and lastly, to just reiterate from the motion, that BNI has demonstrated that all applicable bond release standards have been met. And so the Reclamation Division respectfully recommends approval of this bond release application.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay. Thank you, Randy. I move the... I have them both. I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, issuing certificate of site compatibility number 53 in Foxtail Wind LLC, Foxtail Wind Energy Center, Dickey County, siting application, case number PU-17-284.
Second.
So last July, Foxtail Wind filed an application for a certificate of site compatibility for this wind energy conversion facility known as Foxtail Wind Energy to be located in Dickey County. We deemed that application complete in October and set a hearing date for November 30th at the Fireside Restaurant in Ellendale. We held that hearing as scheduled. This project will be constructed on approximately 20,000 acres of land in western Dickey County. It consists of up to 75 turbines. They've selected two different turbines. Both of turbine models are 2-megawatt turbines, so there would be a total nameplate generating capacity of up to 150 megawatts for this wind facility. Foxtail's entered into a purchase and sale agreement with Northern States Power Company, doing business as XL Energy, under which Foxtail Wind and NSP will seek commission approval to transfer their certificate of site compatibility to NSP. NSP currently intends to construct the project in two phases during 2018 and 2019. Foxtail Wind coordinated with and received feedback from a number of federal, state departments, agencies, and entities. They have undertaken cooperation and collaboration with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and North Dakota Game and Fish regarding potential impacts of the project and seeking to avoid or minimize negative impacts to the project area. It's important to note that no state or federal agency or local government entity has indicated they oppose the project. They also, Foxtail conducted the required cultural resources inventories and surveys, and they received a concurrence letter from the SHPO in late October. Foxtail also undertook and has received some pretty good attention for a voluntary outreach and consultation with Native American tribes to address potential cultural concerns and avoid potential impacts to resources of tribal or cultural significance. This has been kind of identified as a potential model for other projects moving forward. I wish I had the exact number, but I know that there was a large number of resources that the tribes identified that aren't on the SHPO's sites, identified as important to them, and the company made a large number of modifications to the project to avoid those impacting those sites. And in the end, we didn't have any objections from the tribes during our hearing process or at any point throughout this permitting process to this project. So that suggests that they worked through all those issues on the front end and got agreement from the tribes, which is obviously the route that works best for everyone and what we'd like to see moving forward. There's a couple projects within the project area where, due to operation of the project, the sound levels within 100 feet of inhabited residences may exceed 50 decibels, and Foxtail Wind has obtained written waivers from each of these residents, both are of whom are participating in the project. The project and associated facilities are expected to result in permanent disturbance in occupation of up to approximately 98 acres of land. In terms of mitigation measures, all the environmental studies indicate that no federally endangered, threatened, or candidate species were recorded, and no significant impacts to wildlife are anticipated. They have conducted numerous teleconferences and in-person meetings with the North Dakota Game and Fish and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And quite frankly, the coordination with and the information we've received, comments from North Dakota Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service were the most significant challenge for this project. They ultimately, though, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Game and Fish have articulated that an industry-led collaborative referred to as the North Dakota Wind and Wildlife Collaborative is in the process of developing, has not yet been completed, and this is an approach to protect wildlife and native habitats that addresses avoidance, minimization, and offsets where appropriate. It's going to be the way they want to move forward in on all future projects. In light of this effort, Foxtail Wind has coordinated with these two agencies with respect to potential mitigation effort measures and has finalized its WCS, which is a wildlife conservation plan, WCS. I can't remember the exact name of that acronym. And that was submitted as a late filed exhibit. This WCS outlines Foxtail Wind's plan to avoid and minimize impacts to wildlife, avian, and bat species in association with this project, and it also outlines Foxtail's commitment to offer voluntary offsets for unavoidable impacts to native prairie, which was a significant concern identified by Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In addition to that, I already mentioned their commitment, the waivers they received on the sound, and that they've committed that all other areas of inhabited residences, they'll meet the 50 decibel maximum within 100 feet of an inhabited residence. The closest turbine to a non-participating residence is 2,520 feet. So in conclusion, when we were down in the community for this is probably one of the wind facilities where we had the most widespread community support. Nobody came forward and opposed this project or even spoke negatively about it from the community. All entities seemed to be quite favorable about this project. The most significant issues identified were those by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Game and Fish. And we don't have biologists, we don't have wetland experts, we don't have archaeologists. We rely on the expertise of these agencies and others to review and to comment. And so when they do, we take those comments seriously. The company also took those comments seriously and worked in good faith to get through those issues and address them in a way that satisfied those agencies. And we got letters from both of those agencies stating basically as much. So with those things in order, I think that all of the issues identified in the hearing have been addressed, and I'm ready to move forward to support this project.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
I'm going to say that I have some reservations about this. I'm supportive of the motion. I'm supportive of the project. To me, just speaking for myself, the way this grasslands plan is handled here does not necessarily indicate a precedent for me. Until they get that finalized and we see what exactly the company and U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Game and Fish comes up with there, to me the jury's kind of still out. We'll just see once. A couple of things that concerns me, and I never have quite grasped how some of these situations fall under the law, but in the past, North Dakota has not allowed many groups to do perpetual easements. However, I'm told that in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service arena, that there are some that have somehow slipped through. If they start doing perpetual easements, I have a huge problem with that, with thinking that anything we can plan in a current era is good for thousands and thousands of years and just permanently restricts this. So I would be adamantly opposed to these things evolving into perpetual easements. I'm also concerned about the wildlife agencies. People are there because that is what they're passionate about, getting into a situation where they can kind of put the brakes on any project and by saying there are concerns, end up in a situation where they kind of have the power to negotiate some kind of a settlement on their behalf where then they can direct some funds into some favored group's account. And so I'm concerned about what kind of groups ultimately end up with money out of development projects and are then able to go out and compete with people involved in production agriculture. When over the years those kinds of activities have occurred in situations, it can be devastating to a producer out there to lose the rent land that you've rented for years because all of a sudden some agency that doesn't have to pay any federal income tax, much less a lowered rate, suddenly comes in and just can pay almost any price to take something away from you. So I hope that the plan they ultimately finalize will be a responsible one that does not compete with people involved in production agriculture in an unfair way, certainly does not involve perpetual easements, but does in fact protect our biological assets that are out there that rely on having some grasslands for survival.
Is there any further discussion?
I would just add that any time an energy conversion facility goes in, creating the right balance is a challenge. And it's a challenge for landowners that are participating in the project. It can be challenging for those who are outside of the footprint but in proximity to a facility. And taking the necessary steps and asking for the assurances that the land will eventually be restored to its original state down the road creates yet another challenge because it's very difficult to take native prairie and disrupt it and then ever return it to its natural state. But it's a trade-off that we have for living in a modern society. We want to turn the light switch on. We want the lights to come on. We want our homes to be warm in the wintertime, especially in North Dakota. And we want these modern conveniences. So it's always going to be about balance, but there's always some degree of a trade-off. You don't avoid that, whether it's with a renewable resource, whether it's with an existing resource prior to renewables coming on the scene. So doing the right thing and acting in a responsible manner, it's a big part of what a regulatory body is all about and what we continually look at when we go through these particular cases.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay. Thank you, Daryl. My last motion was added here yesterday in an effort to try to recognize that companies are on tight time frames and eager to get things rolling, moving into the construction season. So although this one is a conversion, so there wouldn't be a lot of construction, but I think they're eager to get this one rolling too for obvious reasons. I move the commission deem the application complete and issue a notice of filings and public hearing in One Oak Rocky Midstream LLC, Cherry Creek Pipeline, McKenzie and Williams Counties, citing application case number PU-17-483.
Second.
One Oak Rocky Midstream has filed a consolidated application for a certificate of site compatibility and route permit for the location of approximately 45 miles of 12-inch pipeline existing in McKenzie and Williams County, North Dakota, and is proposing to convert the existing pipeline from a natural gas gathering pipeline to a transmission pipeline capable of transporting 50,000 barrels per day of natural gas liquids. One Oak is proposing to convert its existing state line to Rawson 12-inch pipeline and a portion of its Cherry Creek to Rawson pipeline, both natural gas gathering pipelines, into an NGL transmission pipeline referred to as a 12-inch Cherry Creek lateral pipeline conversion project. The pipeline will originate at One Oak's Lonesome Creek plant, which is on the southern end of the line, and will terminate at One Oak's State Line plant, where it will then be deliver NGLs into the One Oak Bakken Pipeline's Bakken Pipeline and for transport out of state. The Cherry Creek to Rawson Pipeline was built in 2012. It's approximately 6 miles of that pipeline that will be converted. And then the One Oak's Lonesome Creek Pipeline to Rawson Junction would be converted also as part of this project. So the other portion of the line was built in 2011 and 2012. So this is a project that is, again, a reflection of the fact that while we're producing 1.2 million barrels per day of oil, the last time we produced that amount of oil, we produced half as much gas. And so there's just twice as much gas being produced and a lot of oil in our state. And there needs to be gathered, processed, and then there's a lot of this extra product, NGLs, that needs to find its way to market. And that's this is a proposal to use some existing infrastructure, which is something we like, that allows companies to maximize what's already in the ground and not create additional impacts. So convert that in an orderly way to a new use and, again, support the overall goal of capturing, processing, and transporting as much of that natural gas and reducing flaring. So the hearing for this project has been set for March 6th at 9 a.m. at the Ernie French Center in Williston at the Williston Research Extension Center on Highway 2.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Well, generally, the last-minute meeting additions can be frustrating because a person doesn't have time to prepare. I just thank you and especially our staff for getting this moving forward, because you're right, the gas, the handling of the natural gas that's being produced is a big issue in North Dakota, and I don't know what this case will bring, but if it ultimately shows that they meet all the requirements and that a certificate for that conversion is coming, having it done 2 weeks sooner is better than 2 weeks later. So I appreciate that it's on today's agenda.
I would just add that the reality is, and I alluded to this in my opening comments, but the reality is we are going to continue to see a need for more natural gas gathering and transmission infrastructure, not only in North Dakota, but in proximity to North Dakota and frankly, across the country. When you think that current oil production in the Bakken is approximately 1.2 million barrels of oil per day, natural gas production is now exceeding 2 billion cubic feet per day. And that number will only continue to rise. The governor issued a challenge to the oil and gas industry to reach for 2 million barrels. So proportionately, that would push natural gas production up even more. And the tapering off of natural gas from a well, the depletion rate is not as pronounced as it is on the oil side of the equation. So these wells continue to produce significant amounts of natural gas even after the oil production drops. It's dropping on the natural gas side. It's still showing a decline, but not as rapid a decline, so then the percentage of gas compared to oil continues to increase. And moving quickly on projects like this helps to reduce flaring and take advantage of a resource in the state, which isn't our mission directly, or even indirectly, you could argue, but still, as a citizen, it's good for me to see this happening, and from just helping to knock that flaring percentage down, if moving faster accomplishes that, then we'll always do what we can to expedite the process.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
The agenda is complete.
It is.
Okay. We'll move to some announcements. On Friday, this Friday, day after tomorrow, we have a formal hearing here at 9 o'clock. Three cases, PU-17-270, 271, and 322. Those are NSP cases. One of them requiring an advance determination of prudence for some biomass PPAs, deferred accounting for the same, and then deferred accounting on the Laurentian power purchase agreement termination. So that will be an interesting day, starting at 9 o'clock on Friday. Next Thursday, February 8th, we have an informal hearing here on multiple cases, and what it essentially is NSP's resource treatment framework. That begins at 1 o'clock again on February 8th. And even though it's a normal commission date, I want to highlight it anyway. On Wednesday, February 14th, is our regular commission meeting. Pointed out for a couple reasons. First of all, we had moved it to February 15th at one point. Now it's back to the 14th, but it's at 1:30, not 10. So again, February 14th, Wednesday, Valentine's Day, for our regular commission meeting at 1:30. The reason we moved it back from the 15th is that on the 15th was our opportunity to, as we did on your last portfolio item, we squeezed in another natural gas processing related item to take advantage of an opportunity where all the parties could work it out and be here on the 15th, or be in Watford City. 15th of February on Thursday, formal hearing, case number PU-17-397. That's the Aero Bearden gas processing plant. And that hearing will be at Teddy's residential suite in Watford City again, February 15th at 9 a.m. That's all the announcements I have. We will stand in recess for questions from the press, followed by a short break, and then we'll reconvene for the administrative matters portion of the meeting. Dave, why don't you go first?
Well, a couple of clarifications. Commissioner Fedorchuk, the Cherry Creek pipelines, you say they go into the Bakken line?
Not Bakken Link. It goes to the One Oak Bakken Pipelines, Bakken Pipeline.
Okay.
That's, if I'm remembering correctly, I don't see it on the map, but if I'm remembering correctly, that's a line that goes into Montana and south.
And that would probably tie into the new pipeline?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Foxtail Wind, you'd mentioned that you referred to the company several times.
Oh,
was
yes.
Was that Foxtail or was that NSPXL?
It's actually NextEra, but Foxtail is the name of the project.
And NextEra is going through all the siting process, but XL or NSP is going to build it.
Correct. Yes. They're planning to transfer it almost immediately after the permit is completed.
So I think you two are in different. NextEra is going to build it, and then NSP will own it. No.
NextEra is transferring it, and NSP is building it.
Okay. If that is the case, was XL involved in the hearing then?
Not much. They were there, but they were not. But they will be the part of the transfer of the certificate. The bulk of that involves us evaluating whether NSP is able to commit to all the requirements that are outlined in the permit. And so that transfer process, once it's complete, if it's approved, then they will be obligated for all of the things that have been committed to in that permit.
But that could you be hiring third-party inspectors?
We will be hiring third-party inspectors, okay. Yes.
And I'm just going to throw this out. Two of you are running for election. Have you ever walked the state parade?
The state fair parade?
The state fair parade.
Absolutely.
What they call the state parade.
Yes, multiple times.
And how did you find it?
Going onto the viaduct is my favorite part. Going up it, yes. That's
yes. I tried to walk it one time, following a candidate. I think I got two-thirds of the way through, and I said, no, can't do that. So I bow to you if you can do that.
Well, you're welcome to try again this year. We'll have a T-shirt. <to have. laughs>
There will be a number of parades that you'd be more than welcome to take part in.
The state fair parade is a long one, and it's often really hot. But I'll say this, Dave, it's different when you're a candidate. You have a lot more, there's just the energy and adrenaline that keeps you going. You almost don't even know where you're at in the route.
And fueled by the free candy you give out.
Yes, yes, exactly.
There was one other thing, just a little off topic, and that refers to what Randy Christman said in his announcement. He did talk about the rail inspection program, and you know, you hear a few legislators saying, is it necessary anymore? Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask all three of you, is it necessary anymore?
Want me to go first or last?
It's your portfolio.
This is a very timely question because I just met with the inspectors. We try to meet every month and walk through what they're finding, what kind of issues they're having. Yesterday we talked, and I wish I had my report from them in front of me, but there's a couple of things that come to mind that continually reinforce to me the value of the program. First of all, the rail industry is vital to all of our state's leading industries. So having an efficient, safe railroad operating in our state is something that everybody needs. And secondly, in that regard, the railroads go through the very heart of almost every North Dakota community. So a safe system is important from a public safety standpoint as well. So being invested in that, to me, continues to make a lot of sense, especially considering the third piece, which is that the program is paid for by a tax that prior to the establishment of the program was already being paid and collected by the state, and it's paid by the railroads, so they're basically paying for the program themselves. It is not coming from general fund dollars, and the railroads support the program. So those three things are just baseline justification for the program as a whole. On top of that, the program is, those inspectors are doing really important work, and they're making a difference out there. A couple weeks ago, the NTSB released the report on the Heimdall accident, which was a wheel that was broken. They've went through that. Our inspectors have gone through that report and looked at what the findings are. And one of the causes of that finding is shelling on the wheels. It's where the steel flakes off and over time weakens the wheel and it cracks. Our mechanical inspector, Eric, has issued three violations since he started for that very same problem, shelling on a wheel. So he's also issued 7 defects on wheels in general. So there's a direct correlation between that accident, the cause of that accident, and what our inspectors are out there finding. So I think that, can you say he's prevented an accident? No, you can't. But he's out there finding things that we know contribute to accidents. So that, to me, is a very real deliverable of the program and a good justification for continuing to use those monies that were already being collected to improve the safety of a system that we all depend on. So that's one area. The second area, on the track side of things, Carl, our track inspector, has looked at all of our inspectors are inspecting more hours than their counterparts in the federal and the state. Their counterparts in other states as state inspectors and their counterparts in other states and in North Dakota as federal inspectors. Their number of days are significantly higher per year. So they are out in the field a lot. Carl looked at the amount of inspections that have been done on the track since he was added, so comparing before he existed and now, and the number of inspections have doubled since he's been put on board. So that just, I think, again, reinforces that these folks are out there, they're making a difference, and it is going to be contributing to a safer system of which we all rely on. So that's my thought I think it is a smart program, and I hope that legislators see that, will listen, not come in with preconceived notions, listen to the data, and make a decision based on the facts, not just on their preconceived notion about whether this is growing government or not.
I think that one of the good things that we've done in the 2000 2015 session when the program was created was implemented over a period of time. Maybe should have been 6 years instead of 4 years in retrospect, but put it in place for a while with an in date and site, and then evaluate it and make a wise decision. And so if you look at the 4 years of the program, we're about midways through the third year. If you graded the New England Patriots over the last 15 years on the score of the games in the middle of the third period, I think they'd look like pretty much a mediocre team for the last 15 years, and that's clearly not the case. And so that's not when you judge. You judge nearer the end and find out what the end results are. And, of course, in the legislative process, we can't wait until the end of next biennium and then decide. That decision will be made during the session. But there's really another almost a year until I think a thorough evaluation needs to be made. I will say that through the first half of the four-year period and what we've done so far in this biennium, the statistics that we see, the work product that we see from our inspectors has continued to surprise me at the success of that program. And so if I had to guess now, I would say that when we get to the real thorough evaluation phase with the legislature next year, it is going to show that the program is a success and should continue. But there is a little time to gauge a lot more statistics between now and then and really do that thorough evaluation.
When I first started at the commission, and prior to my arrival here, just when I would look at the rail inspection program, I asked the question, why do we have a rail inspection program if there are federal inspectors out there? So if you turn the hands of time back about a year, my answer would have likely been no. I don't think the program needs to be continued. Looking at it today and getting a lot closer to it, yeah, at the end of the day, it's about public safety, and the reality is they continue to find defects out during the course of their inspections. They continue to find things that are wrong, that pose a risk to public safety, and it is about public safety. So one other point, and we have to realize that at the peak, we were moving, and I say we loosely, but the oil and gas industry was moving 850,000 barrels of oil per day by rail. That dropped down to about right around 100 million after Dakota Access began moving product. I think it's crept back to about 150 million barrels of oil per day currently as of today. And I'm pulling that off of a slide that Justin Krinks did. Recently put up at a presentation. So when you have 150,000 barrels of oil moving by rail and then the vast majority moving by pipeline, you have to ask the question, if oil production rises to 2 million barrels per day, how do we move that excess production? And it's a big question that has to be answered. We're talking about potentially another 800,000 barrels of oil production per day in the Bakken. And when you think at the recovery rate in that 7-8%, what if technology, and it will advance, moves the recovery rate to 10-12%? That puts you at 2 million barrels of oil per day without changing the number of drilling rigs, without changing what is currently approximately about a 2-week completion time on wells. So it's very much within grasp, and then we have to ask, okay, short of another major pipeline placement being placed to move product out of the Bakken, how do we get this crude oil to market? So then at the end of the day, how do we make sure that heavy use, again, in terms of transporting by rail, and not just for oil, but whether we're moving any type of a product by rail, how do we do that safely? And the inspectors that we have on staff at the PSC do an incredibly good job of going out and ensuring that public safety is always at the forefront. And they really do a heck of a job even when it's incredibly cold out. I mean, they're out there. They're out there checking things out. So I do think it's an important program, and based on where I think transportation needs are headed, I think we should seriously consider continuing it.
I could ask you one more. Have you read the complaints or the consumer contacts? Have you gone through them?
It depends on what you're going to ask.
Because one Fargo city commissioner is making a lot of noise about XL should bury its lines.
Right.
And he says he's getting a lot of complaints from the tree trimmers because the limbs are falling on lines and causing power outages. So I'm just curious, did you see a lot of that in the complaints?
We talked about it a little bit, and the short answer is no. No, it was more what standard fare, if you will, but not overhead versus underhead or tree trimming type complaints.
And Stacy can provide more detail, but it seems like most of the complaints for the utilities relate to disconnects and billing type issues. And some outages, but mostly it's disconnects.
But not about tree trimming.
Right.
Yeah. And that's a great point. I shouldn't just say standard fare, because there's nothing standard about getting a call from someone when their power's been cut off. They're not happy, obviously. So again, thank you, Stacy, for fielding those calls, and it's important.
I've taken a lot of your time. Thank you.
We appreciate you being here, Dave. Okay, we will reconvene at 11:15 for the administrative portion of the meeting.